You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 18th of April, 2013, on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24. We're live from Studio One in London with me, Dominic Reynolds, and Phil Hahn.
Coming up in the next 60 minutes, James Boyes joins us in the studio to set the day's news agenda with the three stories we need to know today. James, what do you have for us?
Well, this morning, chaps, what I want to be looking at are the breaking stories out of the US with regard to gun control and its failure to pass in the Senate, explosions in Texas, and the surprising developing news that General Musharraf is apparently now on the run in Islamabad.
James will be coming up very shortly. Now, the UN Office of Drugs and Crime estimates the criminal economy in East Asia and the Pacific is worth over $90 billion. We speak to the former head of the Royal Hong Kong Police Criminal Intelligence Bureau to find out what it's like to fight crime in the region.
Italy's parliament gathers today to elect a new president, all the while being unable to create a government. We head to Milan to find out what comes next.
And in today's preview of The Urbanist, we take a listen to the music that makes our cities.
When people think of music in Vienna, most think of Mozart. A tourist in the Austrian capital can find some any night of the week, but beyond the grand concert halls, things are very different.
All that, plus we'll take a ruffle through this morning's Brazilian papers and we play some great music as well. That's all to come in the next hour here on Midori House.
Let's get started with a roundup of your headlines. Here's Barney Burnham.
Monocle 24 News, I'm Barney Burnham. Police in Texas say a number of people have been confirmed dead and more than 100 injured following a massive explosion at a fertilizer plant near the town of Waco. Many more are feared trapped as the blast destroyed many nearby homes and a nursing home. Local police say the scene looks like a war zone. KWTX news anchor Tina Meyer told this morning's edition of The Globalist that news of the explosion came just before 8 p.m. local time on Wednesday evening.
We had frantic radio call from a person who worked at the fertilizer plant saying a fire had started. Immediately, crews were dispatched, firemen, several different firemen were dispatched there. And while they were fighting that fire, an explosion happened. That explosion was felt from miles away. That is probably the worst scenario because all the firefighters are what is feared to be some of the casualties.
Officials investigating the Boston bombing say they've spotted a suspect on CCTV footage from a nearby shop. The president of Boston City Council says the pictures show a man dropping off a bag at the scene of one of Monday's two explosions. Investigators have denied media reports that an arrest has been made. President Obama has condemned shameful politics for the Senate defeat of his proposed measures for tighter gun control. On Wednesday, the plan to extend background checks to online and gun show sales failed on a 54-46 vote, six short of the 60-vote hurdle needed to clear the Senate. The president gave his reaction on the White House lawn, surrounded by the families of victims of gun violence.
A minority in the United States Senate decided it wasn't worth it. They blocked common sense gun reforms, even while these families looked on from the Senate gallery. But the fact is, most of these senators could not offer any good reason why we wouldn't want to make it harder for criminals and those with severe mental illnesses to buy a gun. There were no coherent arguments as to why we wouldn't do this. It came down to politics. So all in all, this was a pretty shameful day for Washington.
The FBI says a man's been arrested on suspicion of sending a letter containing the lethal poison ricin to President Obama. The suspect, named as Paul Kevin Curtis, was arrested in Mississippi. He's also believed to have sent letters containing the poison to the Mississippi Senator Roger Witter and to a state justice official. White House spokesman Jay Carney.
There was a letter sent to, addressed to the president, that at an off-site a mail facility was noticed to have contained a suspicious substance, and tests were undertaken. The FBI has the lead in that investigation, of course, and has said in its statement that they will be conducting further tests to determine what the nature of the substance is.
A court in Pakistan has ordered the arrest of the former president Pervez Musharraf in connection with charges related to his showdown with the judiciary in 2007 when he was still in power. The former army chief returned to Pakistan last month after nearly 4 years of self-imposed exile to contest next month's general election. A spokesman for his party said Islamabad High Court had cancelled his bail and ordered his arrest over allegations that he committed treason when he sacked senior judges and declared emergency rule as he struggled to hold on to power. Critics said he acted unconstitutionally. China is investigating the possibility of human-to-human transmission of a new strain of bird flu that's killed 17 people. The senior health officials quoted as saying that family clusters of people infected with the virus are being examined. Authorities have slaughtered thousands of birds and closed some live poultry markets to slow the rate of human infection. China has warned that the number of infections, 82 so far, could rise. Most of the cases and 11 of the deaths have been in the commercial capital, Shanghai. Those are the main stories here on Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, Barney. Barney will be back in about 24 minutes with another check of the world news. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo. Това е Monocle 24.
Londres, Nova York, Tokyo.
London, New York, Tokyo. Dette er Monocle 24.
Londonist, New Yorkist, Tokyost. Se on Monocle 24.
London, New York, Tokyo, Monocle 24 desu.
Londino, New York, Tokyo.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House. We're live from Studio One here in London. The time is 11.06 in Dubai, 10.06 in Istanbul. That makes it, 8.06 here in London. And we start the show with our daily agenda setter. Three stories you need to know for the next 24 hours.
And today to help us set the agenda is Dr. James Boy, Senior Visiting Research Fellow at King's College London. And he's picked some of the key headline stories from North America and around the world. Good morning to you, James. Breaking news overnight here out of the U.S. state of Texas. Some horrific explosions at a fertilizing plant.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, one of the benefits of doing this show at this time in the morning is we get to see what the breaking news is coming from around the world. And if you think about what's happening in just outside of Waco, Texas, it's remarkable. There's this huge explosion that's taking place at a fertilizer plant, by all accounts. Now, that in itself is one thing. The fatality rate, we're talking apparently already in figures of 75 and upwards, supposedly. Governor Perry's talking about these sort of figures. It comes 20 years almost to the day since the siege of Waco. Some of our older members, myself included, I hate to admit it, will be able to recall. So when you put all that together and you throw in the mix of what's happening in Boston at the moment, it's a really problematic time in the United States at this point. And one wonders where the country is going at this point of it. There's a sense of being out of control a little bit, I think.
Well, there certainly will be that. And I wonder what we're going to talk about some domestic US politics in a second, but I wonder what the effect can be on the electorate of this type of, you know, whether these events are connected or not, whether there's a connection to Waco or in 1994 or not. There is a sense of all of these things coming together and creating a really quite fearful climate, isn't there?
You're absolutely right. I mean, you know, we see the events coming out of Texas overnight. You think about what's going on in Boston, and then you start throwing in the mix the fact that it's very close to the anniversary of what happened in Oklahoma City as well. And then you start thinking, well, hang about a second, where does coincidence end and conspiracy begin?
The rice in envelopes, of course,
absolutely.
We've been hearing about in the news bulletins.
They were clearing the part of the Capitol last night as well. People I knew were evacuated from Capitol Hill overnight. So, you know, there's a real sense of, you know, it's almost like the days after 9/11 again. You know, you're starting this idea of, you know, a climate of fear. And when you're in that climate, you know, everything starts to sort of accumulate. And it doesn't need to be true for it to start having a currency of truth to it.
Because we remember, don't we, that there was a false alarm, wasn't there, some weeks after 9/11 involving a plane in the Manhattan area. And there was this period of time where everybody jumped to the worst possible conclusion.
Well, absolutely.
I'm sure that has an economic effect as well.
It does. And of course, I mean, on 9/11 itself, I remember watching it, and there was all talks that there was a car bomb had exploded at the State Department. Mm-hmm. I was reminded of that when I was watching the news coming out of Boston, because at that point, if you remember, there was talk that the JFK library had been attacked. And I think if that had been the case, then you'd been looking at a wider incident. I mean, thankfully, that just turned out to be a domestic electrical fire. But, you know, when you start start seeing this, and I think CNN got caught out about this overnight. You know, you get ahead of the story if you're not careful. You know, you end up fictionalizing and making things a lot worse.
And it has been indeed a busy couple of weeks for President Barack Obama, and some more disappointing news, I think, for him, especially personally. He was extremely emotional last night during a news conference when he had to tell essentially the nation that his plans for gun control reform had failed in the Senate. It's not looking good, does it?
It really isn't. And the great shame about this is that there's a real gulf between public perception and political reality. Back in the fall, I guess November, December, when the Newton Tower tragedy occurred, a lot of people were suggesting, oh, this is bound to cause a ripple effect and have a knock-on effect, and surely the public officials will listen to the general populace and pass legislation. I don't want to say I told you so, but I was on record as saying that this is unlikely to happen, even though you've got a Democratic majority in the Senate, because fundamentally, this is not a Democrat versus Republican issue, as it's often been portrayed here in Europe, for example. Good Democrats, evil Republicans, because as we saw last night, there are Democrats who are not prepared to vote for gun control legislation. And you can say, well, that's because of the NRA, the National Rifle Association, all you like, but fundamentally, they haven't got the votes to pass this. It failed to get over 60 votes. Now, you might say, well, that's a majority. Sure it is, but it's not a supermajority, so you can't prevent a filibuster. So, you know, they're not going to go forward with this. I mean, even Senator Harry Reid voted against this. Tactically, it's being suggested, but it does send out a signal that, you know, the president can't get handgun control legislation through after something like this. When can you ever get it through?
It's just round one, though, says Obama, amongst statements featuring words like shameful, distortion. He's put accusations of lying at the door of his political opponents as well. He's also said he wants America to sustain some passion about this. Is he alluding to the fact that you were saying there was this sort of swell of support after the Newtown shootings? Is he concerned, do you think, that he's going to lose that momentum that was tragically generated by that event?
President George Herbert Walker Bush used to talk about the big mo, momentum. And in politics, it's everything. And if you don't move fast, you lose that. And there's no doubt, I think, that if Obama really wanted this done and Democrats wanted it done, there was a moment that it could have been done and it was lost. I think most people thought it was lost a long time ago. And I think what's happened overnight is you've seen the realization of that. It's all very well. President Obama can get cross about this and can talk about it being a shameful time. But these issues require leadership, and if he cannot galvanize support on the Hill in the Senate to get more than, what are we looking at, 54 people to vote for a piece of legislation out of a group of 100, then that there's failings on all sides, but it's not just on the Senate.
He did stake, I think, so much of the power of the presidency behind this bill. You know, earlier this year, he had a real charm offensive. He was going to meet Republicans and have dinners. He was going to the Hill. You know, he sent his chief of staff to Capitol Hill yesterday to try to get some votes. So that asks the question, you know, President Obama still has more than 3 years left on his term. Is he now becoming a lame duck president?
Well, whether he put the presidency on the line on this issue is something we could stand here and debate all day. I have to say, I don't think he did. I don't think Obama's really put himself on the line electorally at any point. I think he's played it very safe during the campaign. He didn't campaign on this issue. Let's not kid ourselves. You know, you've spent time in the States. You know how awful gun control situation is over there. If he'd wanted to do this and make it a real centerpiece of his second term, he'd have campaigned on it. He didn't. It didn't become an issue until he got safely re-elected. And he's kind of said, well, I'd like this done, but has he really put the power of the presidency behind it? I suggest that if he had done, you might have had a better situation. And as a response to a charm offensive, I think a lot of people on the Republican side of things think he's just offensive and not necessarily very charming.
Let's move out of the States, at least nominally, to Pervez Musharraf, who is on the run, apparently. Explain.
He is indeed. I think we'll file this under the never go back heading. Some of you might recall a few years ago, tragically, the former leader of Pakistan, Benazir Bhutto, decided to return from exile to seek the highest office in the land once more. She didn't seem to last more than a couple of weeks, if maybe a couple of months, before she was tragically assassinated. Now we've seen something very similar happen. Pervez Musharraf has left his enclave here in London. returned to Pakistan, I think, with the same intentions. And guess what? He hasn't been assassinated, but he was in court and he's been charged and sought to be arrested. But he is now on the run. His security detail took him out of the court, and nobody knows quite where he is at the moment. So we are literally in the midst of a breaking story. Where is Parviz Musharraf?
And he did indeed go back to Pakistan at the end of March to try to run for parliament. Earlier this week, a court ruled that he was unable to run for parliament. So it was all a bit for nothing, wasn't it?
It is indeed. And of course, this is all going back to the time he spent in office. And many people forget, of course, he came to office in a flat coup because of his sort of embrace by George W. Bush during the War on Terror. People tend to forget that he wasn't exactly democratically brought to power. So it's ironic that he's now being brought to book effectively by the very justice system that he sought to impose his iron rule on as leader of Pakistan.
Dr. James Boyes, they're setting the agenda for us with the three stories we'll need to know in the next 24 hours. Many thanks for coming in this morning.
Thanks
now,
a lot.
Coming up still, a new UN report shows crime across East Asia and the Pacific seems to pay. We'll find out how the criminal economy often dwarfs some of the actual economies of the region.
Years of scouring the globe for the world's best baristas means Monocle knows what makes a good cafe, which is why we're making a great one, just a stone's throw away from our London headquarters. Tucked away between neighbourhood shops on Chiltern Street and Marylebone, pop in to the Monocle Cafe for freshly baked pastries, simple delicious lunches, or a delectable dessert, all served alongside artfully made coffee, naturally. Have your cake and eat it, in or out, at London's new Monocle Cafe on Chiltern Street.
The beautifully turned out April issue of Monocle includes our new spring style directory, which takes a look at the best retail projects around the globe, the new shopping neighbourhoods, why Jakarta is on the fashion map, and how the Swiss make the watch world tick. We also take a visit to Tokyo Hands, the famous Japanese store where you can buy everything you didn't know you needed. And we have lots more in this issue too.
In the affairs section, we head to the Turkey-Syria border to discover what NATO is and isn't doing in Syria. We visit the largest Finnish community outside the Nordic region. It's in Canada. And we also meet a woman you might remember, Imelda Marcos, and her shoe collection.
In the business section, we take a sniff at the scent industry. We send our Paris correspondent south to Grasse to find out how the Provençal town is becoming a hub for high-tech innovation. And we introduce a new section, Master and Apprentice. In the first instalment, we profile a man who started tailoring aged 11.
In culture, we ask how you renovate and rebrand one of the world's greatest museums. We visit Amsterdam's Istanbul Rijksmuseum to see what a 10-year sabbatical teaches you. We also investigate high turnover tales in the world of the art postcard and just for a minute give in to the allure of the average, courtesy of our Culture Ed's column.
The April issue of Monocle is on newsstands now, or treat yourself to a subscription. Visit monocle.com now to find out how to join the club.
Now, what if there was a way to harness the revenues of a highly profitable illicit economy, centralise the proceeds and rake off the tax to reinvest into the economies from whence it came? Well, the denizens of East Asia and the Pacific might have hoped there was such a mechanism, as a new report by the UN Office on Drugs and Crime reveals that criminal markets across the region earn organised crime groups over $90 billion. That's roughly double the GDP of Myanmar.
Human trafficking, the trade in counterfeit goods and fake medicines, and environmental waste are among the big money makers. And joining us now on the line to flesh out the details and implications of the report is Giovanni Broussard, Program Officer for the UNODC Regional Office for Southeast Asia and a man who worked on the report. He joins us now on the line from Laos. Giovanni, thanks very much for coming on Midori House. Tell us some of the highlights or the key figures from this report.
Yes, certainly. Good morning and thank you for having me. Yes, this report is the first kind of report that is really investigating every possible form of transnational organized crime in this region. It's a report that depicts a picture that is quite alarming. As you correctly said, we're talking about the total value of criminal flows equal to 90 billion, 90. It's a huge amount of money, two times the GDP of Myanmar, as you said, but also eight times the GDP of Cambodia, or 13 times the GDP of the country from which I'm speaking now, which is Lao PDR. It's a picture that, in some way, is surprising for us. People normally think that the main player in transnational organized crime is represented by drug trafficking. And still, to some extent, it is the case here, where we see that heroin and methamphetamine combined represent one-third of the total value. But on the other hand, we can say that it's just one-third. It means that there are two-thirds of criminal activities that are probably somehow underestimated by governments and law enforcement communities. The biggest flow in this region seems to be related to counterfeit goods. The second biggest flow seems to be related to the movement of illegal wood products. So somehow we see that there is a market that is developing in parallel to the legitimate businesses, which is developing illegitimately. It's making dirty money, and this dirty money can be used for other forms of illegal activities, including human trafficking and drug trafficking.
Giovanni, I wonder, you've alluded to it a little there, but explain to us how tight is the connection between what's going on in the legitimate economy and then what's going on under the surface?
Well, that's a very difficult linkage to establish. What we know is that this region is certainly the region that is growing at the fastest pace in the world. It's the biggest manufacturer in the world of goods, and is also a net exporter of natural resources, including timber. Certainly, a certain extent of corruption and collusion is supporting the development of a black market that develops in the cracks between the public sector and the private sector. We haven't found any evidence of organic involvement of governments into any of these dirty economies, but certainly we can ascertain as a fact that there must be the involvement of government officials, public officials, to some extent, on an individual basis, to allow these criminal activities to flourish.
And Giovanni, you said this is the first report of its kind. You came up with this figure, $90 billion across various sectors, including illicit goods, drugs, human trafficking. What was the methodology used in order to come up with these figures? How did you actually quantify this number of $90 billion?
Well, that's a very good question, and it's not an easy answer, because clearly the main problem is that there is a shortage of data available, depending especially on the flows. For some flows, we must say that there is a lot of existing literature. We didn't conduct any primary research. We based essentially our findings on reliable studies made previously, but then we triangulated those studies with data on seizures happening mainly through customs. So we used a lot of data coming from the World Customs Organization, and we used a lot of data coming from trade, and we tried to extrapolate what's the criminal percent that can be attached to a certain level of trade. Just to give you an example, we somehow combined the data on imports from some countries with the legislation on the alleged exporting countries. And in some cases, we noticed that countries that are not allowed to export anything are actually still exporting a lot of things, according to the data coming from the importing countries.
Giovanni, thanks very much. Giovanni joining us on the line there from Laos. We're now going to turn to a man who spent much of his career working in the prevention of crime in the region. Steve Vickers is the CEO of a risk mitigation and consulting organization based in Hong Kong, and he was the former head of the Royal Hong Kong Police Criminal Intelligence Bureau. Steve, thanks very much for joining us here on Midori House. Now, you spent much of your career on the ground fighting these types of operations. Does this report surprise you at all?
Well, I must be honest. Because you called me on the show, I've read the thing, which is an inch thick. Yeah, it touches on lots of things, some of which aren't really related, and it's lumped together a lot of other things which cause me to question some of the numbers. But setting that to one side, what I think is missing from what's been said, if you're really interested in organized crime and the revenues thereof, what's completely missing from the report is reference to triads and organized crime in the Hong Kong, Macau, southern China, rest of the region implication, which is a very, very large situation. Japanese Yamaguchi-gumi and Japanese organized crime and the Japanese pachinko business, which produces billions, much of which goes to North Korea. The Macau business itself, which again relates to the official gaming revenues, were recognized by the Macau government last year as being $39 billion. But there's an underground VIP room business at least four times that size. It excludes references to weapons, transnational transfer of such weapons. I don't like the stuff in the report relating to counterfeit goods. Remember, counterfeit goods aren't actually worth anything until somebody pays for them. The fact that a genuine high-value item shoe might sell for $500 doesn't make a seizure of 500 boxes worth a multiple of that.
Steve, you've clearly...
I'm clearly not impressed with this as a document.
We can certainly detect that. And also we can detect that you've clearly got a lot of experience in this area and you know a lot of the detail. I suppose from a policing point of view, given that so much is known about the different shapes of organised crime in the region, what are the policing challenges in trying to take it on?
Well, remember, the region is a huge area. I mean, we're talking two-thirds of the world's population. So, you know, anything can happen here. So, I mean, I get fearful of lumping all this into a pot. I mean, the real challenges are under... If the goal is to neutralize and curtail the funds of genuine organized crime, we need to start by working out, well, what is organized crime? I do concur with the report in that they did a touch on and address migrant smuggling and some other serious stuff. There can be no doubt that narcotics trafficking and even cigarette trafficking are generate vast sums of money for organized crime. There's no reference to government sponsored. For us, Laos, for example, a government which is hugely corrupt, is notorious for the award of public works contracts to through kickbacks and the rest, as in other countries, sadly in the immediate vicinity. So corruption is a major area. So what this report does do, I suppose, it's hauled a lot of statistics and pictures together, but doesn't really prioritize and define who the main targets are. The main targets really need to be the main triad societies and Yamaguchi-gumi groups who are functioning in the China/Japan arena. And then counterfeiting is a very complicated business. There's gray market, there's out-and-out counterfeiting. There are companies that facilitate what they call white goods moving across borders. So it's very dangerous to lump those numbers into organized crime figures. Counterfeiting of medicines, however, and things that can, you know, actually damage people's health, that's a whole different discussion, but obviously one that clearly does need to be looked at. So my view on this report is it's an inch thick. Clearly a lot of work has gone into it, a lot of pretty pictures, but I don't think it relates to the hard reality of how it is in the real world.
Steve, we'll have to leave it there, but thank you very much. We're going to speak to Professor Roderick Broadhurst from the ARC Centre for Excellence in Policing and Security School of Regulation at the Australia National University. Roderick, thank you very much for joining us this morning. So Steve Vickers, not very impressed with the way this report has been compiled and the way the findings have been presented. What did you make of the findings?
Yes, well, thanks, sir. Is it Dom or Phil, I think?
It's Dom here, but Phil's waiting.
Okay, thanks, Dom. I gather that might have been Steve Vickers. He's had quite a little experience in the region, obviously, former Hong Kong police officer. But, yes, look, I think a couple of things that are good about the report. I mean, I think it does highlight a couple of things that have shifted. One, I think, that I see just a to paint a positive picture. I mean, I think certainly what Steve's saying about the gambling business, the operation of some of the larger triad, if you like, or black society groups in Greater China and, of course, the Yakuza in Japan. I want to just highlight a couple of things I do think that are good about it, in the sense that it does shift some of the discussion, make it a little bit more, if you like, a little bit more balanced. One is that they've identified that the costs of human trafficking, particularly sex trafficking, much, much lower. If you like, the turnover, the profits, the income is much, much lower in the greater Mekong region than previously argued or supported. And so there's a bit of realism creeping in there. And I think, secondly, I think because it does focus on, if you like, the eastern flow of particularly amphetamine-type stimulants and heroin, you know, from the tri-state area, from the Shan states, Laos and so on, into China, is giving due recognition to the weight of the consumption patterns in China and East Asia. And so in a sense, it's a balance from the previous UNODC Global Assessment Report in 2010, which did, in my view, have a very strong Eurocentric focus. So at least two clear things are happening. One is the message about profits in relation to human trafficking, sex trafficking, much more realistic, much more practical, I think, and also giving due weight, I think, to the general movement of drugs out of the Myanmar Burma area, which still is, in fact, is increasing its production of opium, it seems, but has become a major source of amphetamine. I mean, you can, of course, I think it's also another feature that's worth putting a positive spin on, and that is that the emphasis on both the medical counterfeit product area, which is a very significant one in India and China, and has very important implications for state legitimacy, and of course the focus on environmental crime in general. I think these are all very positive things, and I think they do bring some of these probably lesser, I mean, we tend to over-focus on things like human smuggling and illicit drugs, narcotics and so on, and these are other matters of considerable concern.
Professor Roderick Broadhurst there from the ARC Centre for Excellence in Policing and Security at the Australian National University. Thanks for joining us here on Midori House. In the next half hour of the programme, we'll head to Milan and check in to see at presidential elections and how that will be going. We'll also be having a leaf through some of the Brazilian front pages with our Monocle researcher and Brazilian resident Brazilian, Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Before all that, here is Barney Burnham with the news headlines.
Thanks, Phil. Police in Texas say a number of people have been confirmed dead and more than 100 injured following a massive explosion at a fertilizer plant near the town of Waco. Many more are feared trapped as the blast destroyed many nearby homes and damaged a nursing home. Officials investigating the Boston bombing say they've spotted a suspect on CCTV footage from a nearby shop. The president of Boston City Council says the pictures show a man dropping off a bag at the scene of one of Monday's two explosions. President Obama has condemned shameful politics for the Senate defeat of his proposed measures for tighter gun control. The plan to extend background checks to online and gun show sales failed on a 54-46 vote, six short of the 60-vote hurdle needed to clear the Senate. The FBI says a man's been arrested on suspicion of sending a letter containing the lethal poison ricin to President Obama. The suspect was arrested in Mississippi. He's also believed to have sent letters containing the poison to a senator and a state justice official. A court in Pakistan has ordered the arrest of the former president Pervez Musharraf in connection with charges relating to his showdown with the judiciary in 2007 when he was still in power. The former army chief returned to Pakistan last month after nearly 4 years of self-imposed exile to contest next month's general election. China is investigating the possibility of human-to-human transmission of a new strain of bird flu that's killed 17 people. A senior health official is quoted as saying that family clusters of people infected with the virus are being examined. Those are the headlines at the bottom of the hour here on Monocle 24.
You're back with Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Dominic Reynolds and Phil Hahn. It's 8:34 a.m. here in London, 9:34 a.m. in Milan. That's where we're heading now.
Our correspondent there, Ivan Carvalho, is our man there, and he's on the line with a couple stories making the news. Welcome, Ivan, to the program. Some voting happening for Italy's new president, even though they seem to be unable to create a government.
Yeah, good morning, Phil and Dominic. Yes, in about half hour, both houses of parliament will meet along with some representatives of the Italian regions to select the next president of the republic. And right now, the news coming out is there is a name that the center left and center right have supposedly agreed upon, but that's Franco Marini, a former leader of the Senate. But within Pierluigi Bersani's party, the center-left party, there is some divisions right now about this candidate, thinking that Bersani was making a deal with Berlusconi, and this is something that sort of the Young Turks and people who follow Matteo Renzi, who was an opponent of Bersani in the primary, are saying this is not a good choice. So there's some tension now going into this vote.
I wonder, elections a couple of months ago, if this all doesn't work out as planned, there could be more elections coming up. We were talking about President Obama in the US trying to make sure that public attention stayed focused on the political process. Is there any sense of sort of a little bit of saturation of political wranglings amongst voters in Italy?
Yeah, the people are, it's interesting, people right now, in the recent polls, the Five Star Movement has been suffering a little bit, and Berlusconi has sort of inched up, but if this thing drags out a bit longer, and this deal that the center left supposedly has made with Berlusconi, that might maybe change some people's minds. And of course, Matteo Renzi is he's the sort of the X factor, because on the center left, he's in some ways divisive, but in some ways he's seen as somebody who could unite the center-left if elections are called again quickly, because he was on television last night going out publicly saying that this choice of Marini was bad for the center-left because they need to really go for somebody who's much younger. You know, Marini is 80, Napolitano, the outgoing president, is 87, and Italy needs to look for generational change. That's always been his argument. And right now, if this thing drags out, because it could go on like a papal conclave for several days, because they only do two votes today, and those are secret ballots, and we could go, hopefully, it'll be done quickly, but otherwise, it could drag out for several days if they can't agree on a suitable candidate.
A lot of people, Beppe Grillo's party, he did much better than anyone really expected at the last election. Is there a sense there on the ground that people regret voting for Grillo?
I think that the longer the stalemate goes on, and Grillo continues to be this in his party, this monolithic bloc that doesn't want to do any deals, it could hurt him. He has lost a few percentage points, in the polls, and he attracted votes. I mean, 8 million votes came from suddenly out of nowhere. Where did those votes came from? Actually, they came from people in the center right, center left, who were this delusion with traditional politics of the last 20 years. But if they don't make any sort of concrete sort of reforms, doing a few deals with Bersani, maybe a little bit of compromise, that could be a factor that could hurt him, because right now we have this very odd three-way stalemate going on. So if right now Grillo is talking about another candidate for president of the republic, Stefano Rodotà, law professor, former politician, somebody who's seen as more impartial, and somebody who even people within the Democratic Party are interested in, at least the Young Turks, and there's some talk even right now outside Parliament, interviews going on with parliamentarians walking into Parliament by journalists. So this name could come out, and that could, of course, hurt the center-right, but it could be a candidate if this is somebody that Grillo's people had nominated online as the candidate who accepted. This could be something that could help him. So we'll have to see when the voting starts, what happens.
So, Ivan, stalemate in the world of politics then, but at least Italy can rely on its trusty exports, huh?
Well, one would think so, but unfortunately, more bad economic data has come out just recently about Italy's exports. So, the country is, within Europe, it's second behind Germany in terms of its manufacturing base. But in the last beginning of 2013, the exports have dipped down. Even in overseas, where the emerging markets, where Italy's been hoping to make gains, and of course in continental Europe because of the euro crisis, exports to say like Germany are down 10%. And Italy, there's this big lag between Italy and Germany. You think they're second behind Germany in terms of the industrial base, manufacturing base, but the gap is quite large. And you look at the numbers. I mean, Germany exports €1 trillion. Italy's about €500 billion. Because there's a lot of small and medium-sized businesses. Italy doesn't have a lot of those big sort of Bosch, Siemens, BMW, does have Fiat, but there's so many of those large German brands, and some recent studies going out about some of the perceptions of Italy in these emerging markets like Brazil and Russia and China. They seem to be a bit behind Germany in terms of perception. People do like Italian goods. They like the fashion. But there's also some, I think, perceptions, negative perceptions. The political impasse doesn't help, I think, Italy in this. And, you know, German prime ministers, or they go to chancellors, they go to these meetings with their businessmen, these delegations. Italy can't do that right now. There is no these gatherings with these summits with business people coming along with, you know, the president or the prime minister, like you see in a lot of other places. And that's definitely a factor that's hurting them right now. So, the political impasse, even the head of the employers union was saying recently, you know, Italy has thrown away about 1% of its GDP by this. We're at almost 2 months of deadlock right now, and it's really bringing down the economic prospects of some of these businesses.
Some more bad news there for Italy, unfortunately. That was Monocle's man in Milan, Ivan Carvalho. Thanks for joining us here. You're listening to Midori House. We'll be back after this with news that thanks to a new app, you no longer have to Bjork your cousin in Iceland. It's good news for you, Dom. We'll have more on that in a moment.
Every weekend here on Monocle 24, we like to take a break from the rigours of our hard-hitting news agenda and have a leisurely look at the arts.
Anything can be made interesting by looking at something long enough or from the right angle.
Starting at 8 a.m. London time on Saturdays, the weekend edition brings you a mix of music, news, and very special guests with me, Georgina Godwin.
I discovered that I was enjoying listening to it as a piece of music, not just as an installation in that gallery. I thought, this sounds like a new album.
I'll be talking to a variety of talent from the worlds of literature, music, theatre and television, as well as introducing you to new selections from our global playlist.
It's something entrenched and strange, and it's a mysterious relationship with your own creativity, and it's a lifelong negotiation.
That's the weekend edition, Saturday from 8 a.m. and Sundays from 16 to 1800 hours, London time, right here on Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House. The time here in London is 8:42.
It is indeed. Now, if you were compiling a list of the world's most awkward pillow talk conversations, finding that your new lover is actually your cousin would likely come out on top.
That's awkward.
Yes, it is, isn't it? From experience, Phil?
No.
No, clearly not. And apparently there has been rather a lot of such awkwardness lately in Iceland. The population there is a little more than 250,000 in all, of course, so you can see how they have problems.
But a team of developers there have come to the aid of those who find themselves in the midst of unintentional naked family reunions. There is now an app that will tell you if you're related to the person you're about to get friendly with. All you've got to do is touch your phones together, just your phones, and the app will tell you if you should proceed with any more touching. Well, Alexander Annes Helgason is the co-creator of Icelandinga Bók, or Book of Icelanders, and he now joins us on the line. Alexander, a very novel invention here. Tell us a bit about this app, and is this a big problem in Iceland?
Hi, and thank you for having me. The main goal of this app was actually to bring the Book of Icelanders, which is an online database where you can search any Icelander that has lived in history and see how you're related to him. And we wanted to bring this to the smartphones, and to make this a little bit more fun than just searching for a fellow Icelander, we decided to add this feature where you can bump the phones together and to find out how you're related. And while doing that, we discovered that it would probably be very fun and nice for those partying downtown to be able to see.
Well, it's clearly been very popular, so lots of people are finding it fun. I mean, I wonder, we've approached this with our tongues in our cheek, but is this is the popularity, and it's been downloaded lots and lots of times, which I'm sure you're delighted about, is its popularity out of genuine concern about this issue, or is it just a bit of fun?
I think it's mostly just a bit of fun. I at least haven't heard of anyone that has actually encountered this problem, though there is one review on the App Store that says, I wish I had had this app last year, because then I probably wouldn't have gone home with my cousin. But we aren't really sure if this is a joke or not, but let's hope so.
Well, as of last a couple of hours ago, it's been downloaded some 3,651 times in Iceland. So obviously, it may be a problem for some people. Do you see any? You know, could this be expanded to other parts of the world?
Maybe our cousins in the Faroe Islands, but I'm not really sure if any other countries has this database where you can search your fellow countrymen. So it would probably be hard for other countries to implement this, unless they would make you register, like, who are your family members.
Well, I guess that's part of the issue, isn't it? I wonder how far back it goes, because this is just cross-referred with a sort of DNA database, isn't it? I mean, I guess you go far back enough and everyone's related. Is there a point at which you've decided that interaction of that sort is not okay? Does some sort of alarm go off once you discover your first cousins?
Yeah, the app actually plays an alarm sound, like... if you're too closely related, and we decided to draw the line according to Icelandic law, which is any relative from your grandfather or grandmother and below. So
thank you very much.
The case when you
Alexander, thanks very much for coming on the show. A fascinating app, something that I'm sure we'll keep an eye on. Alexander Anis Helgeson, co-creator of Icelandic Book.
And what better excuse than this to play some music from one of Iceland's favourite exports, of course. This is Isabel by Björk. Isabel there from Björk.
Globalist Asia is our brand new show covering global stories, but with a focus on what's shaping the business day from Beijing to Bangkok, Singapore to Sydney.
My vision of the Japan, how I see with this, I grew up in Paris, but that's how I see Japan.
There are also fresh insights from our global network of correspondents, contributors and editors, including a survey of the Asian front pages.
We're going to disagree to disagree, and we're just going to keep doing it and doing it and doing it, and no one really has a playbook for how this turns out at all.
So tune in to The Globalist Asia every weekday for your global news digest. That's The Globalist Asia at 3 a.m. in Hong Kong, 4 a.m. in Tokyo, and 6 a.m. in Sydney. Brought to you in association with GE.
And welcome back. You're listening to Midori House with me, Phil Hahn, and Dominic Reynolds. And it's time to have a leaf through the Brazilian front pages. And Fernando Augusto Pacheco is our resident Brazilian journalist here. And he's come down into the studio with a ruffle of some of the papers this morning. What's that caught your attention, Fernando?
Hello, Phil and Don. Today, let's start with the main news. It's the story that's on the cover of O Globo, which is the main newspaper from Rio de Janeiro, and Folha de São Paulo, which is the main newspaper from São Paulo. And, basically, the interest rate rose for the first time since 2011 in Brazil. And it's interesting because the reason because of that is the increasing inflation that's affecting many Brazilians. So especially food prices. I mean, I think we spoke about that here at Monaco before, the tomato crisis where prices went up by more than 400%. But this is still ongoing story in Brazil. Everybody's talking about because everybody is affected by food prices, of course, and especially tomatoes. I mean, I'm sure not many people are making their pizzas, you know, at home.
And what's Dilma doing about it?
Well, so basically, she's trying to control this inflation, rising the interest rate. And it's been a polemic decision because basically Brazil has already quite a high interest rate compared to other countries. But, I mean, she needs to do something. And Brazil has a very terrible record on inflation. I mean, if you go back in the early 90s, we had horrible inflation. We had a terrible economic crisis. And even our previous president at that time, Fernando Collor, he was impeached because, I mean, it was such a horrible crisis. So we had bad memories. So I hope this will not continues.
And how are the Brazilian papers reacting to the news of this? Are they welcoming the higher interest rates in a bid to lower inflation?
Actually, I was reading an editorial for Folha de São Paulo. They are welcoming. They said kind of I mean, she needs to do something. And to be honest, the raise was not that high. The only interesting thing that they rose the interest rate. It was not because it was on a decreasing mood, but not anymore. So
there's a picture on the front of O Globo which has caught my attention, as I'm sure it has everyone else's. Phil, what do you make of that?
It is hilarious.
I love this picture.
It's extraordinary, isn't it? So you would think this woman getting off the Rio City bus. Just getting off the bus on an ordinary day, but the front of the bus is stuck in a building.
Exactly. And the bus hits it on a news agent as well, let's say that. But you know what I like about this picture is her reaction. She's reacting in a very carioca way, which is people from Rio. Very nonchalant, you know, oh, whatever, you know, the bus just hits an office building and... Yeah. Oh, and by the way, nobody died. I mean, nothing happened.
It was probably just close to her stop.
Yeah, that's it.
She's probably happy.
And look at that. She's even with her bag, you know, very
very chilled, very slowly. Off to the beach. Might take another 5 minutes to get there. Now I've crashed into a building, but it's cool. Everything's cool.
And that was in Ipanema as well, you know, very close to the beach. So, you know, come on.
And another story out of Brazil that's caught your attention. Good news, at least in your opinion, I think, in terms of whether it's possible to create a political party in Brazil.
Well, I think that's a good news because basically it's actually they want to restrict the creation of new political parties. But I'm going to explain why this is a good news in my opinion, because in Brazil we have so many political parties. Basically in the Congress at the moment we have, I believe, more than 20 political parties being represented there. And with so many political parties, of course, you become more susceptible for corruption in a way. And that's why Brazil is well known for being a corrupt country. So basically now the government is going to restrict public money for these new political parties. Of course, there's been quite a lot of critics on that, especially Marina Silva. I don't know if you guys know her. In the 2010 presidential elections, she used to be our Green Party leader and she was the third most voted candidate. And she's about to create a new party. And she said that actually this was... Dilma's effort to restrict the opposition and everything. She might be right in some ways, but we need to sort it out something. Otherwise, our Congress, it's a mess. And for example, when Dilma is elected, she can't govern only with her Workers' Party coalition, because otherwise she wouldn't manage to govern the country, you know? So she needs to kind of do a lot of meetings here and there with basically more than 20 political parties. So I think that's a good step forward. But of course, we need to make sure that, I mean, if you want to create a new political party, if it's a serious one, if you have enough political capital, then you should go ahead. But it shouldn't be that easy, in my opinion.
Okay. Let's talk about one of the stories that's been never off the front pages for about a week and a half. That's the death of Margaret Thatcher. Give us the take from Brazil.
Exactly. It's kind of a funny one. I mean, Folha de São Paulo, we have a Brazilian comedian called José Simão. He's an iconic. I mean, he has a daily column I read every day. It's extremely funny. And it's interesting that he's always on the front page of Folha de São Paulo. And instead of pictures of the Margaret Thatcher's funeral, they have like a little quote from him. I mean, I hope it's not on a bad taste, but you know, he says... oh, sorry for that. You know, but basically he's saying that if he would be in London, he would be screaming, Viva Cristina Kirchner on the streets, you know? And I guess, you know, the relation between Argentina and the UK, you know? So, I mean, I just find it interesting to take on Folha de São Paulo instead of doing like a more... I'm sure they have the coverage inside the paper, like of the whole funeral and everything, but they chose... this quote to be on the cover.
I suppose it's interesting, isn't it? Because here domestically, there's been a lot of hand wringing and chin stroking about exactly what it is or isn't appropriate to say after the death of such a divisive figure. But I guess the further you get away geographically from it, the less people worry about saying things like that.
Exactly. So we can say Viva Cristina Kirchner on the cover.
You know, the funeral, of course, did take place yesterday in London. A lot of people were worried that there was going to be outbreaks of violence, protests. But I think generally, as a whole, the funeral was very respectful. Everyone on the procession route was very respectful. I think there was one case of a group of protesters. They weren't even screaming or shouting. They just turned their backs on the procession.
They performed their own U-turns in reference to her classic line.
And one thing I have to say, I mean, even though I'm not sure how Margaret Thatcher is perceived in Brazil exactly, but everybody knew her. So I'm not sure if many people know who David Cameron is, but certainly I would say the majority know who Thatcher was.
And lots of people would suggest that any female leader, looking at Argentina, of course, has Margaret Thatcher to thank in some respect for their position. That's all we have time for on our show today. Thanks, Fernando, for your paper review. Fernando was also one of the researchers on today's show, along with Barbara Feeney. Alid John was our producer. Sam Impey was behind the desk as studio manager. Now, up after the news, it's Culture with Robert Bound. I will be back with Midori House, along with Phil, same time tomorrow. Thanks for listening.
Bye-bye.
A Rolex timepiece represents an ongoing commitment to innovation, horological expertise, and the passion of skilled watchmakers. All add up to make the one principle by which Rolex lives, that greatness is a journey that never ends. Rolex.